Unless you've been living in a cave, you've heard a lot about the Pebble Mine prospect in the Bristol Bay region, which could become the largest open pit mine in America, next to America's largest salmon fishery. But behind the campaigns for and against the project, it hasn't been easy to find out facts to help reasonable people decide how they feel about whether Pebble is right or wrong. I'm Charles Wolfort, sitting in for Steve Heimel. In the next hour, we're going to answer your questions about geology, fish, and anything you want to know. It's Pebble 101 on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits, from research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, good morning. We're diving into the deep end today on Talk of Alaska. Perhaps Alaska's most controversial issue, the Pebble Prospect, the prospect of building this huge mine in the Bristol Bay region. In the news, of course, there was a vote. The people of the Lake and Peninsula Borough voted very narrowly by 34 votes for an ordinance that would is intended to sidetrack Pebble. That's going to court. And you've all heard their ads on the television and all the different debate, which is so black and white, for and against. Well, we decided to do something different. We're going to try to do a sort of a public radio version here of this controversy, where we're going to talk to people who are not on either side of the issue, folks who can give us some straight information, answer your questions about what Pebble is all about, what the Bristol Bay fisheries are all about, and maybe answer some things that don't have that tinge of controversy. We're not going to avoid controversy. We certainly want to hear people's points of view. But our objective here is to give you the straight information from disinterested parties. And in a little while, I'm going to introduce two professors that I have as guests today from University of Alaska Anchorage and from University of Washington, who will be our experts. But first, I thought it would be a good idea to introduce the topic by talking about the process of how a project like this is approved and permitted by the state of Alaska, so that we'll sort of have the basic understanding of where this goes through the process of coming from idea into potential project or not. And for that discussion, I'm going to talk for a few minutes with Sharman Stambaugh, who's with the Office of Project Management, the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, and she's joining us by phone and has gone to quite a bit of trouble to be able to do that. And I very much appreciate your being with us, Sharman. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks very much, Charles. Appreciate it.
So we're permitting process. I assume it takes a long time and has a lot of parts to it. What's the sort of overall philosophy or the overall objective in doing the state's permitting process of a large project? I realize that Pebble has not applied for its development permit yet. It's still figuring out, I guess, exactly what they want to do. Assuming they do apply, what will you have to do and what sort of issues will you look at?
Okay. Well, first of all, I work in DNR's large project management group, and we are in the commissioner's office, and we are a coordinator of all the other state agencies who look at all the different pieces of reviewing and permitting a project, and we work on other projects as well as mines like oil and gas, large roads. So that's our role in the Office of Project Management and Permitting. We work with all of the different disciplines in natural resources, environmental conservation, Department of Fish and Game, Commerce and Community Development, and Health and Social Services. So we work with the applicant, and we work with the federal agencies, and we work with the state agencies, and we work with the public. A lot of people want to know what is a large mine. We do not have a definition of it, but Pebble is definitely, if it were to be a project instead of prospect, it is a large mine. The things that determine whether we coordinate a project is the size of the project, where it is, for mining, the type of deposit, the ore chemistry, if it has potential to impact natural resources or the environment or people, where it's located, either on state or federal land. All this feeds into the level of coordination that the state has to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of... Go ahead.
You asked questions. The typical progression of us working on a mining project is, as you said, there is a prospect. Somebody has gone out, they have done the geophysical surveys, they've done the geological mapping, they've done enough work that they think there is something of economic viability there. So then they start sort of parallel tracks. They're working on their own site surveys to understand the deposit, and at the same time, they're starting to collect data, baseline environmental data, about the impacted resources, water, fish, wildlife, vegetation, air quality. So that's kind of where Pebble is right now. They have exploration permits that they have gotten from the state. The Pebble exploration project is largely on state land, so they have to get miscellaneous land use permits to use that land. They've had to get temporary water use permits to use water resources for drilling, and they've had to work with fish and game to protect fish from, you know, any sort of impact to the water bodies they're taking water from.
Yeah, and I know that's another big issue, but let me, once they submit a permit request or application, how long would you expect it to be before the state would make a decision and issue a permit? Or I suppose the also possible that they could, that the state could say, we won't issue a permit, but in terms of the time span from application to decision, how long would you expect that to be?
It can take years. It really depends on a lot of the factors that I mentioned earlier, the potential impact of the project, the complexity of the project. A main thing that determines the sequence is if a major federal action is triggered, and it's usually a permit to remove materials and wetlands, and that would require the Army Corps to be involved. They oversee any kind of projects that would, you know, use wetlands in either permanent or temporarily impact wetlands. So that federal action triggers something called the National Environmental Policy Act. You may know the initials NEPA.
Mm-hmm.
And
so then
part of
doing
NEPA,
an EIS or Environmental Impact Statement.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. That's exactly right. And that is why they're taking all of that environmental baseline data, because that's a required part of the NEPA EIS process. Now, the Pebble project has not gotten that far yet. They're still in the baseline data collection.
Right.
No federal agency has officially been identified as a lead agency for the federal agencies.
Now, something I've always wondered, and maybe this is just a naive question, but it seems to me any large project will have environmental impact of some kind. Obviously, we can't do almost anything without having some environmental impact, and so therefore it would seem that those giving the permits would have to decide, well, how much is enough environmental impact, and how are those judgment calls made, or what's the process? Who makes those decisions?
The federal agency, who is the lead agency, decides what level of review. There are some projects that don't have what they consider broad enough impacts that they have to go through an individual review.
Mm-hmm. But this is obviously a big one.
Categorical exclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but a big one would have to go through either an environmental assessment or the large one is called an environmental impact statement. And that is determined just by the receiving environment, if there's discharges into water, if there are emissions mm-hmm. into air, if there are other competing resources in the agency in the area that they have to, weigh the consequences of the action.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very involved process.
Right.
Usually it's so involved that the lead agency contracts it out to a specialist to do. A project this big usually would not be done in-house by either the Army Corps or whatever federal agency is the lead agency.
From the point of view of state permitting, who would make those judgment calls if they need to be made? Would it be made by ultimately by the commissioner, by the governor, by a staff person, or who would make those calls about, you know, what kind of protections need to be in place? Or even, I suppose, though it doesn't seem to happen very often, that no permit is issued because the impact is too great.
Well, first of all, you would have to look at the design of the project. You have to look at the elements on the ground. Is there a dam? Is there a mill that's going to process ore? Are they using chemicals at that mill? Is the ore itself have some potential impact for metals leaching or acid rock drainage? All of that baseline work has to be in place. A very, very large portion of the work that the agencies do is looking at sort of water management and water balance. What water is being consumed? What water is being recycled? What water is being discharged into surface water or onto land? If it's going into surface waters, the level of review is quite high with the Department of Environmental Conservation.
But are those decisions made? I mean, who actually looks at that data and says yes or no or these conditions? I mean, is that written into the laws? Who decides?
Yes, each individual agency has its own regulations, and in the case of DEC, it's water quality standards. So they base their decision on the type of permit that would be needed and the protection within that permit on all the impacts. They have to know what the expected water quality of the discharges that they're going to permit. And that's where all of this baseline work. They actually run laboratory tests. They do bench tests to figure out what kind of process they're going to use to extract the valuable minerals. Then they're going to, you know, sort of mock up a treatment system, and then they even mock up weathering onto the waste rock to, you know, in very controlled laboratory tests. Of course, this isn't the real world, but it is a basis for a lot of the decisions. They take these laboratory tests. They take modeling. It's how this is done. They take as much data as they possibly can, and they apply their own regulatory requirements.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. That was Sharman Stambaugh from the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Charles, and I'm wishing all your listeners a happy Alaska Day.
All right. Yeah, it's a day off for the state of Alaska, so you've been contributed some of your time off. We appreciate it.
Thank you, and good luck to the rest of your show. I'm sorry I can't listen. Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
So the show is Talk of Alaska Statewide. My name is Charles Woolforth. I'm sitting in today for Steve Heimel. We're talking about the Pebble Prospect, trying to answer some basic questions about this project and how it might roll out and what kind of impacts it might have, what it might be worth, all of those things. All kinds of questions and comments are open, and you can get on the air with us by calling 8... I'm sorry, I was looking at the wrong number. 800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. And in Anchorage, it's 550-8422. And you can also send us an email at talkofalaska@alaskapublic.org. I want to get that. We talked permitting, and as usual, it doesn't seem as simple as you would like it to be. But I'd like now to get into some of the facts on the ground. I have two guests. Dr. Christian Schart is a professor of economic geology at the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Thank you for being with us. And Dr. Daniel Schindler is a professor of aquatic and fishery science at the University of Washington, joining us from Seattle. Oh, sounds like we've lost Dr. Schindler, but we'll get him back shortly. Dr. Schart, this is truly a huge project, and we're used to things being big in Alaska, but can you give us a sense of how this prospect and how the potential mine stacks up against prospects and projects around the world?
Sure. One of the things I was actually looking at is the actual size. And if people know a little bit about copper mining, we have a very good example in the U.S., which is the Bingham Mine. And there's also another mine in Indonesia, which is called the Grasberg mine. And this deposit will actually be, in terms of tonnage, will be bigger than both of them. So simply looking in terms of size, it's going to be much bigger in its magnitude and also in its resources than anything we have currently explored or mining to date.
So is that just because of the amount of ore that they think is there, that it's just a huge amount of riches that's under the earth out there?
Right. In terms of tonnage, that means the amount of rock that the ore sits in. It's just, so much bigger than anything else we know at the moment.
Mm-hmm. So what does that mean in terms of impact? I mean, does bigger mean more impact in terms of, like, it has to be a bigger hole, essentially, just to put it in sort of terms that we can envision?
Right. Some of the figures I saw talk about a hole that's about 2 miles wide and several thousand feet deep. And that sort of compares with the Bingham mine in Utah. But I can imagine, depending on what the ore body looks like, where the ore is concentrated most, that the hole could be wider and could be deeper. There's some limitations with regards to how deep you can make this hole before you have to stop in terms of technical limitations.
Mm-hmm.
But there's the potential for the hole of being at least as big, if not bigger, than anything we've seen so far.
Wow. So in terms of the economics of it, how much value of ore is potentially there? And I guess you have to think about it in terms of how much you can recover and how much it costs to recover, and some might be recoverable, some not. Is it possible to make estimates on that?
Well, the figures that have been released, and that's from January 2010, they're about 5.9 billion tons of ore, which sounds a lot. But if you look at the actual metal content, we have about 0.4% of copper and about 250 ppm, which is one part in a million, of molybdenum, with about 0.35 grams of gold. So speaking in terms of richness, the ore grade is actually comparable low, but due to the fact that it's so big deposit, so 5.9 billion tons, it's just a huge amount of material and rock that can and will be mined in order to get the metal out.
Mm-hmm. So how much have they been able to put it, or can you put a dollar amount roughly? I mean, we're talking billions of dollars.
Oh, yeah, we're talking billions of dollars. I don't have the exact numbers, but it's going to be several hundred billion, I do imagine. You have to remember that this also depends on the metal price.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the current prices of copper, and of course everyone probably knows the gold price is up very high, but copper seems to be at a five-year high as well. And, you know, if copper prices stay that way, then of course revenue will be a lot bigger. But on the other hand, if the copper price drops significantly, which I guess will depend on how much countries like China, India demand from the world market, that will really impact the overall costs of the project and the revenue as well.
Mm-hmm. What's the most important metal? Is it gold, copper, or molybdenum from this prospect?
Well, copper would be the main element or the main metal mined, with gold and molybdenum being a accessory that will be mined in the process of getting the copper out.
Mm-hmm. And the process of mining is simply getting this immense amount of material out and then somehow separating the metals out of the material. I mean, that's sort of the essence of it, right?
Right. The ore minerals are mostly contained in veins, which are usually, you know, half an inch to a couple inch wide regions where the ore is concentrated, or very finely distributed in the whole rock. So it's not just a matter of following one geological unit and mining it out, but you basically have to get all the rock out, mill it up in order to get the metal out.
I see. Is there any possibility of this being what we think of as an old-time underground mine as opposed to just a big hole in the ground, or is these a huge pit is just the tradition, how it's done now?
Well, with the metal concentrations as they are, you have to keep in mind that the Pebble project is actually a twofold thing. One thing is very close to the surface with only about, I don't know, 50 meters of overburden. So that will definitely be a open pit mine. And due to the fairly low metal concentrations, that's really the only viable option of mining it. The what's called Pebble East is much deeper. And there, I think, the only viable method, provided that the metal prices stay where they are or even climb higher, will be an underground mine. So I think eventually this will have to be a twofold project.
I see. Okay. Well, so that's our good introduction from Dr. Christian Chart, who's a professor of economic geology at University of Alaska Anchorage. And I've chosen our guests today because they don't have any direct interest. They're not working for either side. They haven't they're professors. They're coming from an academic point of view, and they have expertise. And my other guest, who's now with us, is Dr. Daniel Schindler, who's a professor of aquatic and fisheries sciences at the University of Washington. Dr. Schindler, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for the invitation.
So now we've heard about the size and the wealth of this prospect from a mineral point of view. I know that your program has been studying the fisheries in the Bristol Bay region for many, many decades. Can you give us a sense of just how important that fishery is, how large it is, and sort of how it stacks up on a world scale?
Yeah, so the most of the fishery wealth in Bristol Bay, at least from a commercial standpoint, is in sockeye salmon, which one way to put that in perspective is to think about the value of all of the United States fisheries for the last 50 years, and Bristol Bay sockeye is the most important at the scale of the United States. The other way to put it in perspective is to think about where do all the sockeye salmon come from that show up on the world market, and again, the biggest piece of what shows up and is sold globally comes from Bristol Bay. Although we like to focus on sockeye and the commercial aspects of it, there are also all the other species, king salmon, coho salmon, silver salmon, present throughout the bay. And then, of course, there is enormous value in the subsistence fisheries, which have developed and persisted for probably millennia based on the reliable annual return of salmon to their rivers and streams throughout this landscape.
So how obviously the sockeye salmon are fish that come back from the ocean and spawn in fresh water and then rear in lakes and go back to, you know, most Alaskans probably know that cycle. In terms of looking at this potential mine, and overlaying it on the system there of rivers and lakes, how big is it or how important is it in terms of the entirety of this fishery?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things that are worth thinking about to answer that question. The first is to ask, why is Bristol Bay such a unique place from the perspective of salmon habitat? And that is largely a function of its glacial history. 15,000 years ago or so, the area was covered in glaciers, and as those glaciers moved around and receded, they produced a lot of gravel. And now you pour some rainfall and snowfall on top of that gravel, and you have basically a very wet landscape where water moves pretty freely across it. And those are the type of habitat conditions that salmon thrive in. Unfortunately, when you start thinking about mineral development, those same geological and hydrological conditions are what make it a major challenge to retain any environmental waste, or particularly in the case of metal mining, etc.
So in other words, the water quality issue becomes one of, if you're digging up this enormous hole and you're putting all this rock and dealing with chemicals and so forth, that water is running every different direction. So how do you keep it where it belongs and not contaminate a large area? Whereas the actual footprint might not be that large in comparison to the whole region. Is that kind of what you're saying?
That's the next level of it. I mean, mm-hmm. I think most of us tend to focus on the footprint that'll receive the most intense mining activities. You know, how big is the pit going to be? How big is the tailings pond going to be? But, you know, we've learned from history elsewhere that it's often the accumulation of what we often consider subtle effects that may take decades to develop and play out that often are the bad ones in terms of reducing viability of habitat. And in this case, we're talking about building roads, putting in culverts, putting in power lines. You add all those more subtle effects that often occur over broader expanses of space. You add those to the more localized, dramatic effects associated with a pit, and that's when you start talking about potential for long-term degradation of the habitat.
I see. So it's not even if you don't spill any toxins, the fact that you're bringing economic development and human development to the region seems to affect salmon and how many salmon you can get expect to get out of that area.
Exactly, and you know this is why it makes it a very difficult assessment to figure out what the real environmental risks are. You know, we heard about speculation for what the value, the economic value of the ore is. You know, we really need to think about speculating about what the environmental risks are. And we need to be explicit about what are the impacts, what's the possibility of different levels of impacts, and then what's the probability that they will occur. And that quickly becomes a really complicated set of calculations that, you know, we often don't have a good basis for doing those calculations.
All right. Well, thanks, Dr. Schindler, and I'm sure we're going to have a lot more questions. You're going to stay on the line from Seattle. I'd now like to, we have a number of calls, and we're going to work through all your questions and get our experts on the line here. I've got a call now from Representative Les Guerra, who I guess my note here says dying cell battery, so I wanted to get him on quickly. And you wanted to say something about permitting, Les?
Sure. A few things, Charles. Thanks for doing this. This is great. First of all, you know, the law got changed a few years ago that's going to vastly impact this. Under the Murkowski administration, they weakened our water quality rules that in a way that's going to allow the permit of a mine like this much more easily. We used to require no pollution in salmon spawning waters, and the Murkowski administration rolled that rule back. You know, there are a lot of politicians out there, the last two governors, who said just let the permitting process take its course. Well, that's code word for saying let the mine get approved. I mean, the feds might step in, but if it's a state decision under the state standards, you know, a governor sort of and a commissioner sort of have the discretion in reviewing these standards to say yes or no. And with the political climate in Juneau, I think this is a governor and a commissioner that are going to say yes to this pebble mine. So people have to keep in mind that you know, the water quality rules got rolled back. And just one other point, you know, a lot of this has become a fight about personality, and the personality should be put to the side. But, you know, obviously you've got corporate money on one side. You have Bob Gillum's money on the other side. But Bob's taken a lot of hits. And frankly, he has no money to gain over this thing. So I think a lot of the personal attacks against him have been pretty unfair. And with that, I'm happy to take questions, but I just wanted to make those points.
Yeah, thanks for the points. And I think the permitting one is an interesting one. Who actually decides? It was hard to get an answer to that earlier. But we're going to sort of stay out of some of the politics in terms of the back and forth, because we've heard so much about that. And now I'd like to go to James, who had a comment from Eagle River. James?
Hi. I'd like to present a one-sentence, boiled-down summation of some of the risks, and it goes like this. Show me an example of a large open-pit sulfide mine that has not impacted water quality or fisheries 10 years after it is opened or 10 years after it is closed. Close quote. Unfortunately, there's not a single example worldwide where this can be demonstrated. And we are putting at risk something that is clearly never been successfully done before.
All right. That's an excellent question, and we're going to get an answer from that. Let's start with the geologist in the studio, Dr. Chart. Is that true? Are there examples of mines that didn't affect the water quality of this type? Or is that something you know about?
Well, you have to keep in mind, and I mean, he's certainly right that there's always an impact, but you have to keep in mind any type of activity you do, you remove the topsoil, you start mining, you start blasting rock, that will always going to be an impact, no matter what, even if you just open a quarry to mine rock with no ore in it. So water will always be affected. It's then a question of what is the deposit? Where is it located? Is it in an area where it's very dry, like the Bingham mine, where you don't really have population sitting right next to it, where you don't have huge waterways, and also the hydrogeology, which is how and to what extent does the water have access to the mining activities. That will all determine what the environmental impact is, but it's also true that everyone wants to have good cars, nice phones, everything. So the metal has to come from somewhere, and there will always going to be an impact. There's nothing for free.
All right. Well, we have another. This first half hour has gone by really quickly. We're going to be back for more discussion about the Pebble Prospect, the Pebble Mine, and we'll get Dr. Schindler's opinion on that last question when we return. I'll also be giving out the phone numbers and contact information if you want to get on the air as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. And by Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AK Business Month or Facebook.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth, sitting in for Steve Heimel. Our topic today is Pebble 101, the Pebble Mine Prospect, and the basics, your questions and comments. We have two experts, Dr. Christian Schart, professor of economic geology from the University of Alaska Anchorage, is in the studio. And on the line from Seattle is Dr. Daniel Schindler, professor of aquatic and fisheries sciences at the University of Washington. And for you to get on the air, give us a call. The toll-free number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-8255. If you're inside Anchorage, it's 550-8422. And you can also send an email to talkofalaska@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Schindler, you heard the question from the caller. Has there ever been a mine that didn't mess up the water quality and fisheries? And I'm just interested in what your perspective is on that question. Is it something that is inevitable if you build a mine in an area like this, that you're going to lose some fish, and just a question of how many fish you're going to lose? Or have you thought about that?
I think my answer will restate what's already been said. I think we can say with 100% certainty that a mine of this size is going to have effects on water quality and on fish habitat. But that's not really the question we should focus on. The question is, how big are those impacts? How expansive? How many fish will be lost? It may be zero. It may be a really big number. And then the second level of question is, what's the probability of one of these, of a catastrophic failure, the probability of long-term chronic degradation of habitat? What are the probabilities of those things occurring? And this is where we need to think about the trade-offs. What are the costs and benefits? Over what time frame are we willing to think about? And to answer those questions, I think we do need to draw on history of mining elsewhere and ask what is the history of mining and its effect on water quality. And, history is quite colorful in that regard. I'm not sure there are many good examples of places where mines of this size, well, first of all, there are no mines of this size adjacent to fisheries of this size, so we're dealing with a somewhat unique situation. But aside from that, I think the caller is correct. There are not good examples of this. And, if Alaska decides to decide their permitting process based on, for instance, some of these lab experiments that the DNR representative mentioned, I think one thing to keep in mind is it's really difficult to simulate how Mother Nature works in the laboratory. And ecology has realized that we can't pretend that a small, clean experiment that we can perform in the lab will actually tell us much meaningful about what the real impacts are out there in the real world. So we need to be really cautious when we assess these risks, and history tells us what some of those risks are.
Well, it sounds like you're saying there's going to be whoever makes this decision will be making a decision based on a lot of uncertainty, And in some sense, it'll be a values decision because some of the impacts are simply related to human development and the question of whether the Bristol Bay region should be sort of set aside and not have human development because of fish would be sort of one end of that value decision.
Absolutely. I mean, it's no role for science to determine what's acceptable. I mean, what scientists should be doing, whether they're geologists or economists or biologists, is laying out what the risks are and what the potential benefits are. You know, the question of what's acceptable, which you asked earlier in the program, is a social decision. That's a values decision that science can only inform. Science doesn't answer that question.
Mm. Now I'd like to turn to Matt, who's calling from the Bristol Bay region. He's in Dillingham, and he's been waiting a long time. Matt, what's your question?
Well, I have a comment. I just have a hard time grasping the whole reclamation in perpetuity phase of this type of development. It just seems that so many of our nation's Superfund sites are mined. That's just wanted to get that in there.
So in terms of, like, can you reclaim? If you build something like this, how do you reclaim? Is that what you're saying?
Well, they put up a bond, and they tend to be woefully inadequate as far as their size. And, you know, the corporations tend to reorganize once the mine is played out. So you can't really sue them, and they escape with profits. And it's just the same old story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, let me turn to Professor Chart. How does reclamation work with these big projects, and what does it mean exactly? I mean, you're trying to put things back the way they were to some extent, but of course you've taken out a lot of material. What is the reclamation process normally? I mean, if it's ideally done?
Well, in an ideal case, and that is actually written into the permitting, as far as I'm concerned, is that the company will be held responsible to do cleanup to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. So in the case of where an open pit mine is basically mined out, the company is actually required to restore the surrounding areas, whether it's the waste pile or the rock that they didn't need is stored, or the actual pit itself, to some type of condition where it is acceptable for the, I guess, the environment and the community to leave it in the state it is. As you said, you can never return it to its original state. That's impossible. But there are rules in place to prevent, for example, a long-term exposure, at least mitigate this one, to either cover it up with soil or some other type of material to prevent further ingress of oxygen and water to work on the remaining ore. And also with regards to the hydrology, of course, these holes usually fill up with water. And in several cases, you will actually develop a type of biotope there where, you know, animals start to come back. And while it's not ideal, it is possible to bring it back to a stage that for the benefit we derive from getting the metals out, it's acceptable to leave. But again, this is a political decision. You know, what would we like to have in the end when everything is played out?
Mm-hmm. And how long in the future? I mean, a prospect of this size and mining it out to the end, obviously it'd be decades. It could be 50 years, or what sort of time frame do these huge mines usually operate?
I'm not an expert on the reclamation side of things, but I know from other studies that they're required to show that the surrounding mining area and the pit itself needs to be stable with regards to the water level, with regards to the contamination. They need to be stable not just for a year or five, but for decades to come. I said that really varies also from project to project.
Right, but you wouldn't start reclamation presumably till you're done mining. How long would you anticipate that the mine would last as a mine? They'd still be able to be taking material out.
Well, the projections I've seen actually vary anywhere from 30 to, I think, 50 or even 70 years. So if everything plays out, and there's still some uncertainty with regards to the exact geology and the ore deposit distribution and whether you will actually develop this underground mine. The lifespan of this project, should it go ahead, will be decades as well. And what usually also happens is that you actually have to start putting certain environmental processes in play or in place once you start mining. So once you take the first material out, it has to be stored in a certain way, it has to be protected, and so forth. So it's an ongoing process.
I see, yeah. Well, let's now go to Bjorn, who's calling from Homer and has a comment, something about online resources. Bjorn?
Yeah, hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, thanks, Charles. This is a great show, really important, and just wanted to say real quick, thank you for all of the great writing that you've done here.
Oh, thank you.
But I just wanted to kind of speak to what you kind of part of your opening statement was, you know, that the propaganda machines are, you know, working overtime on this project, and I think it's difficult for a lot of people to, you know, come to sound decisions with such an enormous project. And wanted to point out a Soldovia-based website called Ground Truth Trekking that has a tremendous amount of information about, you know, this issue, other metals mines in Alaska, and then also really great articles about, you know, perpetual waste storage and, you know, kind of all the related topics. And just wanted to kind of, you know, throw that out there real quick for the audience to, you know, if they're unaware of it, to really please check it out. There's, you know, just a lot of non-biased scientific, content of that I think really helps.
Great. And what was the address there then?
Groundtruthtrekking.org.
Groundtruthtrekking.org. Okay. Well, thanks for that, Bjorn. And I've got an email here, a caller who points out that China has been withholding or leveraging some of its rare exotic metals. I think they're talking about the rare earths. And the question is, would any of those metals potentially come from Pebble? Professor Shard, is it just copper, gold, and molybdenum, or potentially these other rare earths or other minerals?
No, that's a good question. Actually, the byproducts that I mentioned before will be some amount of silver, and then also elements like rhenium and palladium. And while these are not rare earth elements, some of the more exotic metals will come out of it. But in terms of the rare earth elements, none of the things that we hear about indium or germanium will be coming out of this mine. And if they do, then in very, very small amounts.
I see. Now, in terms of the copper, molybdenum, gold and some of these other metals, is there a chemical process that's used to separate those ores from the rock on site? Or how is that done exactly? I mean, what is the... I suppose some work would be done there and some somewhere else. Can you... And I know they haven't said what they're going to do, but in a typical mine... How is that done? Do they have to build a plant, or how do they go about it?
There are basically two ways to do that. One is processing it on-site, as you said, and the other one is just to produce a concentrate, or what they call a slurry, and then transport that to a refining facility. And I think the plan here is, that's based on the information I have, is to produce a metal slurry, so basically grind it up and then pump it through a pipeline to a port that will be built, where the slurry will then be dewatered, put on ships, and then shipped off to a refinery. So those are the two ways. I don't think they will refine it here. At least I have not heard of that.
And is that because of that's an additional environmental impact, or is it a labor issue that you don't want to? It's a hard place to do work, or
my assumption is, and again, I don't have the information, is that it's involves a lot of chemicals, mm-hmm. and it also will require a huge. Processing facility, which I assume they said is probably not worth building for this project. As I said, I don't have the information, but
right.
My guess is that's one of the reasons they ship it out.
Yeah. And listeners may be wondering, well, why don't we have somebody from the Pebble Partnership answering those questions? And that decision was mine in setting up the show. I wanted to get away from the one side versus the other kind of debate that's had held sway for quite some time about this project, and bring in a couple of academic experts, Dr. Shard here from the University of Alaska Anchorage and Dr. Schindler from University of Washington, who can answer your questions and give you basically, if no one in the world is completely unbiased, but would give you information that has no taint of one side or the other. And it's been an interesting process setting up the show. It was quite an investigation on my part to find folks who didn't have somebody who would tell them what they could or could not say, or that have some sort of sense of being on one side or the other, and that for me was very interesting. But I think we've done it, and so I would welcome your calls and questions. We've got a few more online that we'll get to here in a moment, and more are certainly welcome. If you want to get on the air, call 800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, you can make a local call at 550-8422. And we also take emails at talkofalaska@alaskapublic.org. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'm sitting in today for Steve Heimel, and we'll be back in just a moment as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. October is Alaska Energy Awareness Month, a time to focus on what we're doing to meet Alaska's energy needs and reduce consumption in our everyday lives. For more information, go to akenergyefficiency.org. Energy efficiency in Alaska, it's common sense. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
And we're back. I'm Charles Wolfort, sitting in for Steve Heimel on Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the Pebble Prospect, the Pebble Mine, with Dr. Christian Chart, Professor of Economic Geology, University of Alaska Anchorage, and Dr. Daniel Schindler, Professor of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences at University of Washington, and of course, your questions. And now I'd like to turn to Daniel, who's calling from Homer. Daniel?
Good morning.
Yes, and did you have a comment or a question?
Good morning.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, am I on the air?
You are. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry to be sloppy with my phone.
No problem.
Hey, listen, gentlemen, thank you so much for this forum and discussion. It's pretty stimulating. Down here in Homer, people are impassioned about the Pebble Project. There are more folks here against having mining done in the single most pristine salmon spawning ground on the planet Earth. And then there are those who are for the Pebble Mine and its mineral extraction. I'm middle of the road on it. I'm not going to jump to any conclusions or become impassioned myself. I'd like to have more information before I make a judgment call. And thanks to you and your fine staff and having these gentlemen on the panel today in the discussion, that helps folks like us attain more information and increase our education on the issue. I would think that if it came down to it, I would suggest that a circulation of a petition for the people to sign, registered voters, that is, to sign with the question, shall there be a pebble mine, yes or no? I would like to say, I don't have a crystal ball, but I'd like to say that the overwhelming majority of the citizens of the state of Alaska would check the no box, because this is all we got. This is our diamond, and we're about to, I think, wreak havoc in the area and lay waste to the single most pristine salmon spawning ground on the planet Earth. However, somebody made a good point just the other day when I suggested, well, let's circulate a petition and get the voters, the people, to decide whether a foreign corporation can come in and dig a hole in the ground deeper than the Statue of Liberty is tall and several hundred football fields long, full of toxic waste, on top of the single most pristine.
All right, let's get to the point, Daniel. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. What I want to know is, do you think that would have an impact on the decision if the people of Alaska signed a petition and said, hell no, we don't want this mine? I try to tell people in all my cynicism that it would probably be shoved aside and the mine would go in anyway. And a good example of that is when the people of the United States voted Al Gore as president of the United States by a large margin, and a group of people we never met appointed a Bush to the job.
All right.
So anyway, thank you so much for your time, gentlemen. Have a fine day, and thanks a lot.
Okay. Well, thanks for your call. I think that points up some of the distrust that maybe the public has with permitting processes and government. And I'm trying to stay a little bit more on the technical aspects of this, because I think that that's some of the information that's been missing. I had a question for you, Dr. Schindler, about the issue of water quality and the sensitivity of salmon to contamination of water. I know that during the Exxon Valdez oil spill, there was some study that took place having to do with very, very small amounts of petroleum in water that would have sublethal effects on salmon. In other words, the salmon would appear to be okay. There wouldn't be any outward sign of a problem, but the reproduction would be depressed, and over time runs would be weakened. And I'm wondering if there's been a study that would look at potential water contamination, maybe at a low level coming from a mine, or from other kinds of contamination, and how those might affect salmon runs?
Yeah, it's a very good question. There's not a straightforward, easy answer. I think if there was, we wouldn't be debating this to the degree we are. The simple answer is that when anyone does an assessment of the impact, potential impact of a contaminant or a slurry of contaminants, you really need to think about the whole life cycle of the organism. And what's more typical is that people will take a life stage of the salmon, for instance, the eggs or the fry as they've recently emerged, and do a short-term experiment where you assess, you know, for instance, how many of them survive at different concentrations of the contaminant. But in the end, that only tells you about that life stage. You know, if you want to do an appropriate assessment, you need to think about how it plays out over the course of the entire life cycle of salmon. In the case of elements like copper, we know that copper, as an example, inhibits the ability of salmon to smell. And, of course, salmon come home to the stream that they were themselves born in, and the way they get there is by smelling home. So that in itself is an example of the type of complexity you need to think about when you do a full-blown assessment of potential impacts of a contaminant. In the case of mining metals and how it affects fish populations, I think it's safe to say that most assessments are really done at sort of a life stage in a beaker type assessment, and is pretty hard to do the full life cycle assessment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is where I think that, you know, you need to turn to history and ask where have mines been developed, where the fisheries have maintained themselves. The big challenge, as I mentioned earlier in the program, with Bristol Bay, and this, of course, is the reason salmon love the place, is there's so much water out there. And that water is what's going to move those contaminants around. You look at the other big mines in the U.S., maybe some of the listeners have seen the huge open-pit mine in Salt Lake City. Remember, those are in deserts. There's mm-hmm. no water to move the contaminants around. And that's the biggest challenge with Bristol Bay, is there's tons of water, and it moves everywhere.
And what watersheds are we talking about? Which rivers would be affected potentially if there were some kind of contamination coming from the mine?
Well, the mine is sitting in a saddle basically between rivers that drain into the Quijack drainage, which is, I think, most people will recognize Lake Iliamna, and then on the other side are rivers and streams that drain into the Nooshigak River.
I've got a question from email, which is on point for your comment you just made. She asks, if our experts, are either of you familiar with the mines Grasberg, Octeti, Panguna, Bougainville in Papua New Guinea and West Papua? I've probably mispronounced them because I'm certainly unfamiliar with them. The environmental, political, and social impacts of these are devastating, says the emailer. Grasberg, in particular, is of interest to our situation. Dr. Shard, are you familiar with those, and can you comment?
Yes, of course. They are quite well known, both of them, Papua New Guinea and Indonesia. And there, you have to keep in mind that the government placed an emphasis of getting investment into the country and mining the mine. So there is a very different process in terms of protecting the environment. So one can compare that. But we have very different regulations in place. So the environmental impact, even though the situation may be similar, I think would be very different. A lot of things that go on there would, in my opinion, not be permitted here.
I see. Now I'd like to go to Nancy, who's calling from Talkeetna with a question about earthquakes. Nancy?
Yes, I've been in Alaska close to 60 years, and I came from Montana, where I went through the 59 earthquake down there that literally split a mountain in half and blocked off a river and created a lake. And I'm wondering how they think all this junk that's going to be backed up behind this mine, adding pressure onto the dam, is going to withstand a really major earthquake when they can be either vertical or upthrust. We don't know. It could open vast crevices through the mine. It could open underground chasms that could drain it out. There's no way of guaranteeing that they can protect it from earthquakes. That's one of the biggest powers on Earth.
Okay, good question. Dr. Chart, how would you take into account earthquakes?
Well, that's certainly one thing that the planners would actually be required by law to take into account. There's actually a fault called Lake Clark Fault that's fairly close to the deposit itself. But since we don't know where the rock piles would be deposited, it's really hard to say, and as the caller just mentioned, it's impossible to predict. We have seen major earthquakes that have shifted the ground very little or had devastating consequences, so it's really impossible to predict what will happen.
And we're kind of going to do a speed round here because we've got a lot of callers and commenters and not much time left. Here's an email that I'll direct to you, Dr. Schindler. Listener says, there's only one reason why Bristol Bay has the world's largest salmon runs, and that is because we've chosen to destroy all the other salmon runs around the globe, from Europe to the Atlantic coast to the Pacific coast. Some of those losses may be due to overfishing, but the main reason is because we've polluted or fragmented the freshwater habitat. We need to draw the line and make a decision to protect the environment for all our long-term benefit and not look at the short-term gain or profit for a few people or corporation. This is from Mark in Dillingham. I guess the question there for you, Dr. Schindler, is what has caused the decline of salmon around the world? I suppose Bristol Bay probably would have been a pretty big one at any time, but obviously Atlantic salmon and West Coast salmon have severely declined.
Yeah, it's an interesting perspective. I think it's important to keep in mind that, well, two things. One, if you come to the lower 48 and Washington, Oregon, California, it's very clear that the biggest source of problems for salmon has been due to loss of habitat. And that's both due to eliminating access by putting up hydro dams, but also through some of the more subtle chronic effects associated with road development, with mining development, with overfishing, with hatcheries, etc. So habitat is a huge issue in places where salmon are not doing well. If we could dial back the clock, let's say 200 years or 400 years for Europe, and ask how big would Bristol Bay be at a global scale, I'm pretty sure Bristol Bay would still come out at one of the top one or two, maybe three watersheds in the world. So Alaska is really in a unique position where the habitat is still viable. It's still incredibly productive. And, you know, whoever makes this decision is making a critical decision for the future of salmon, both in Alaska and in the world.
Thank you. Well, I guess that'll be our last word. And many more questions and comments. I wish we could have gotten to them all, but I really want to thank our guests today, Dr. Christian Chart, Professor of Economic Geology, University of Alaska Anchorage, Dr. Daniel Schindler, Professor of Aquatic and Fishery Science, University of Washington. My name is Charles Woolforth. I was sitting in today for Steve Heimel. Thanks also to Dave Waldron, who did a great job running it in the booth. And that's it for today for Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com. Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits, from research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.